Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Deborah Ball has been working in naming, branding, content creation, marketing, and communications for more than 10 years in the UK and the US. Her special focus has been brand naming. She has a master's in linguistics from the University of Oxford and an MBA from Durham University Business School. Over the years, she has immersed herself in the study of naming, including the grammar of brand names, to understand how meaning is more fully shaped when phonetic forms are placed in context. Topics discussed include naming, market research, Egyptology, neurolinguistics, marketing, project management, medtech, and brand strategy. Links to Deborah's LinkedIn profile and other resources are in the show notes. I would like to welcome our guest today, Deborah Ball. Hi, Deborah. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
I know Deborah, not only because she's a linguist, but also because we are both members of the American Name Society. That's my other life. I was president of the Name Society for several years, and Deborah gave a great presentation a couple of years ago about brand names, because that's one of the many things that she does. And I will actually put a link to that in the show notes, because you can pop over to the Name Society's YouTube channel and you can listen to that presentation, because it's really good.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. It's been, like you said, it's been a couple of years.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years. But it was really interesting. So I will start by asking you the question I ask everybody, which is, how did you find out about linguistics and decide that that was something you were going to do in your college career?
Well, I've always had an interest in languages and linguistics and just how language works. At school, it was very much, French and Spanish and sort of European languages that were accessible growing up in England. And I just always really liked, if I take a step back, I used to live in France when I was little for about 6 years. So I could already speak French. And then when we moved back to England, I wanted to keep that up. And they offered us Spanish as well. So I always just had that interest anyway. But looking towards university, I was thinking actually more of history. So I always had a passion for ancient history as well. And I ended up studying Egyptology, which at Oxford, which funny enough is actually an intensive language degree. I think some people think it's heavy history, which there is a heavy amount of history, but actually it's language. It's learning about hieroglyphics across the thousands of years that it existed. And so that's a really kind of fascinating world as to how language changes.
Yeah.
And especially hieroglyphics, it's not languages as we know it with letters. You've got the sort of, pictorial element to it, which is obviously fascinating. But it has grammar and it works just like other languages. And it's something that it's kind of a historical relic as well that you can see. And that kind of fascinated me. But as I was going through that degree, I kind of realized, the super passionate people who end up doing it for their careers, it's the 0.0001% of people. And you truly have to be passionate to continue doing it, through to PhD and onwards. And obviously the pay is not going to sort of match unless you are those superstars. So, while I'm studying Egyptology, I'm kind of thinking, okay, so what do I do after this? How do I have a career? And so I took a bit of a post-uni gap year where I went traveling. I actually went scuba diving just cool. Because why not? You can see I actually went to Honduras so I could use a little bit of Spanish, and it was a sort of a means to have a bit of a break from studying for a long time. And just linguistics popped up. It was just a way of translating an interest in language into something maybe more usable for finding jobs. So how language worked. So back to Oxford to do a master's in linguistics. And the focus was, everybody has to do general linguistic theory. So you're going through phonetics, phonology, semantics, syntax, pragmatics, all of that. And then you get to pick two specialties. So I picked neurolinguistics and the theory of translation. Something interesting about neurolinguistics was that it actually wasn't offered. I was trying to figure out ways to do some kind of tangential linguistics that wasn't as traditional, like forensic linguistics and things like that. But someone had told me, oh, you know, Professor John Coleman, he has an interest in neurolinguistics. So I actually approached him at one of the linguistics dinners that we had and said, I'm just really interested in how language works in the brain. Would you be interested in just offering this? And he was. So he actually, you know, there wasn't a class. He just tutored me for an hour every week, gave me the materials, and I would write essays. And that was, and then it sort of ended up on the exams again. But that was kind of the, I don't know, the interest behind, you know, how language works and sort of pursuing different interests, even though they're not available. But that's kind of, yeah, the academic side of linguistics. So I did my master's, and then I went, and then the question popped up again, you know, what do I do now? So I've got this linguistics master's, and I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, business, and I'll do something that's kind of content marketing, advertising, branding. And, you know, it's kind of all over the place. But the first time I heard that there was actually something called naming that you could do as a job. Was a job advert I saw on the careers website, the university careers website, for Origin Brand Consultants, this small company just outside of London. And I went there to interview, and it was, you know, a really great interview. And I actually interviewed there twice. And I was just thinking, oh my gosh, I really hope I get this. Like, how cool is it to just name things for a living? It didn't work out, unfortunately, because I think he was saying the creative director at the time, they just kind of internally restructured. And a learning actually from this was to, I should have said, how about an internship? You know, just how about some stepping stone into that world instead of, you know, committing to hiring. But anyway, it didn't work out. But then that was the moment like, okay, naming and branding, that's cool. How do I, you know, continue to pursue that? So that's kind of how the beginnings of linguistics happened, and then the beginnings of being aware that naming and branding even existed.
I'm always shocked that there aren't more linguists in naming and branding. There should be hundreds, right? Doesn't it just seem like it's the most natural fit in the world? Because it, especially naming, right? It's all about language, and it's not even the creative aspect of it, but there's so much strategy, and so much about it is just like pure linguistics, right? Like all of those things that you mentioned before, right? Every single aspect that we consider like the primary divisions of linguistics, phonetics and the syntax and semantics and phonology, like all of that is in naming. And it feels like naming should be run by linguists. This is what I feel.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you say that. It's surprising when you do speak to people, and obviously you kind of look around on LinkedIn and you're like, okay, what's the kind of person, what qualifications that they have to get, and what experience do they have to be able to do naming or just branding in general? And you're like, well, it's quite varied, you know, sometimes they do this access program, or they have English literature or something different. But no, yeah, I rarely saw a linguist, and that was whether I was interviewing for other companies or where I ended up with Addison Whitney. It was just, yeah, no linguists. You're totally right. And so after Origin Brand Consultants, I was, you know, searching for these companies, and Interbrand pops up, and you're like, okay, that's a very well renowned company. Mm-hmm. It has a verbal identity department. Let's see if I can get in touch with someone. And I do, I have a few conversations. Unfortunately, it doesn't sort of go anywhere. And then the sort of hiccup is that I moved to America to marry my now husband. So I just had to sort of switch job markets from England to America. And most of those types of companies, they are headquartered in either, you know, the Northeast or in California. So, you know, the search starts again for trying to find these types of companies that even offer that. And actually, my husband was stationed in Fort Bragg in North Carolina, and that's where we were living for some time. And then I found these companies, this little cluster in Charlotte, North Carolina. And so that's where I started applying to those. And actually, I think they all come from Addison Whitney, but they sort of split off over the years.
Correct. That's absolutely what happens. Yes.
So yeah, I mean, that's how I heard about naming there, and then ended up there. But again, very, very different sort of backgrounds in terms of the degrees that they have and the work experience that they have to some extent. And actually, it's not to be critical at all, because actually having that diverse pool of people to think about names and create names is great. You know, you don't want everybody to think in exactly the same way. But to your point, if you had a linguist, you can think about the linguistic aspects of building names, which, you know, how do you break them apart? How do you put them together? You know, what letter strings can you use? What shouldn't you use? Singular, plural, you know, if you put an S on the end, just really simple things. Does it sound like it's plural? Does it sound like it's belonging to something? Do we want that effect? Do we not? So actually that kind of linguistic thinking could make for really super creative names, but also catch some that maybe you would suggest to clients, well, maybe that's probably not a good fit, or is a good fit, or this is riskier, this is not as risky, and you can bucket it that way. I was surprised that when you've got this type of work that it wouldn't be a lot more linguistic. Like it could offer the field of the business of naming so much more, but it currently doesn't. It's quite a gap, I think.
Yeah. I think it's partly due to just the history of the naming industry in general, because naming as a field is not very old, right? It grew out of marketing in sort of the late 60s and early 70s and hasn't really stood on its own two feet for very long at all, since like the 80s. And there haven't been naming firms, like dedicated naming firms, for all that very long at all. When I first got started in the late 90s, that was just starting to be a thing. Naming had always been part of the larger firms like Interbrand and Landor. They'd just been folded in with all those other pieces of branding and marketing. So it's pretty new. And I feel like this is hyperbolic, but I feel like I know all the linguists who are in naming. It's funny, I was just at a naming conference, like I think one of the first naming conferences, maybe even the first, that was held here in the Bay Area a couple of weeks ago.
I've heard about that.
Yeah, it was great. It was really good. And I met two linguists who were there. There were 55 people in attendance, and I think we were the three linguists who were there. And they will be appearing on this podcast in the not too distant future. So just giving people a preview of that. And it was really cool to meet them. And yeah, it was great to see the variety of people who were there, who had all these different interesting backgrounds. And there were artists and fine arts people and just all kinds of different folks. But just weird, right? In a room of 55 people, three linguists, it feels like there should be more.
So. Yeah, no, I'm surprised. The odds would say to us that, yes, there should be more, but there aren't. And it kind of just goes to show that there's a big opportunity there for linguists, I think, to really put their training to practice and actually contribute a lot. So I wish I could have gone, but obviously I just have a young family, sort of two toddlers, and I couldn't make the trip, but I'm glad. Yeah, I did. I'm curious, actually, did the three linguists who were there, including yourself, was there a talk on how linguists could benefit the business of naming, or not yet?
Not yet. There will be next year. And I might be giving that talk. So it was a really good day. And I was assured that there will be next year another day and maybe 2 days worth of talks. Everybody was very big on it. It was a huge success and we all had a good time. So yes, I think people seemed very eager to hear more about linguistics and how important it could be and what we could do to expand it. And I have, personally helped in a small way other linguists get into the naming industry, because I think, as I said, it's just such a natural fit. So there are more people from the linguistic background who are now in naming than there used to be. And I always encourage people who have a linguistic background to try it, you know, just try, because there's room. And once people find out how valuable you are as a linguist in naming, they're, you know, then you can start to evangelize for hiring more, because that's what I do all the time. When people say, what kind of person should we hire? It's like, oh man, you need to hire a linguist for this. That's exactly the kind of person you need.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Because it's a way of thinking that might not naturally come to someone with just a different type of background. So if you had your ideal mix of a naming team, you definitely want a linguist on there just to understand, again, like how language works. But then you'd also want maybe someone with an English literature background or a history background or a scientific background, just to add the mix outside of that world, to be a little bit more creative. Or you can throw a group of people together to come up with a bunch of names and it'll rarely be the same. Like it'll rarely get even one that's overlapping.
Yep, absolutely. So I'm during the course of this podcast, I've talked a lot about what I've done in naming. What have you done in naming? Like, have you been on the creative side or on the strategic side, or have you done it all? What have you done in naming?
Yeah, a bit of everything, actually. So okay. When I finally did step into the world of naming, that was at Addison Whitney. And I actually joined as a verbal branding associate. So I had done, you know, a couple of jobs before, and I decided to stop climbing a ladder, basically, that I didn't really want to climb, and just start at the beginning of one I did want to climb. So that's what I did. We actually moved to Charlotte for a couple of years, where I met everybody and I worked with the team. Learned about how to create names. And actually, Addison Whitney is a healthcare company.
Yes,
so
very specialized. Yeah, very good at what they do.
Oh, good. That's good to hear.
Oh, yeah.
So it's mostly healthcare, you know, pharmaceuticals and medical devices. But actually, I'd say it's about, maybe that's changed now, but 80 to 20%. So 80% healthcare and then 20% other things. Because I actually did projects which were, yes, pharmaceuticals and medical devices, but also a shoe company, a cheese company, just Microsoft, Panasonic, all these other tech companies as well. So there was a nice mix to, you know, the day-to-day where you're having to create a lot of names. And it's actually a great stepping stone, because you sort of realize that there's some linguistics to naming, but the process can be built to where, I know, you have projects and you have to come up with names as swiftly as possible, and then you've got to screen them. Mm-hmm. I think it's something that people just don't realize, that when you're thinking about a naming job, creativity and coming up with a name is a portion of it.
Yeah.
Screening it and making sure it's even available is the bigger portion of it. So it's something that you learn, but then that's the strategic bit. Right. So you've got the creative bit and the strategic bit. You've got to have, you know, fun coming up with the names and working with the client to try and get, you know, what they want, but also something you recommend. And then you've got to check that it's a strong name to have. It's going to do what it needs to do. So that was a good, I think, insight into the business aspect of it and the strategic aspect of it. Mm-hmm. But then I quickly realized that I just wanted to work with clients for a bigger chunk of time. So instead of purely being a namer, I actually wanted to sort of be more of a consultant. Mm-hmm. So I asked the team there, you know, could I just move from basically being a verbal branding associate to a sort of more account management role or consultant role? So working with a client from the beginning right to the end. So I actually joined the European team. So I had a great boss, Sacha Marcel Pochet. He headed up the European team. And I basically asked, you know, do you mind if I kind of join your team? Because I want to, you know, work on cool projects and just kind of guide clients through the naming process, and also just be a consultant. But I think the way that the work can be structured sometimes, it can be quite siloed. So you're either business development or you're account management or you're a namer or you're this or you're that. And I really wanted to try and blend those things a little bit more. So the deal was basically is that if, you know, do the account management role, in that I would support, you know, his projects and do the sort of typical activities that account management would. And if I could find business, if I could bring business in, then I could lead it. So I would also, so that's how I sort of dipped my toe into the business development world and selling, which I think is a really key skill to have in any kind of role, is being able to do outreach. So to put yourself out there and speak to people and then win business. So I had a few projects that way where I would lead it and run it, and then I would gather the team, the lead, you know, verbal, or the verbal lead rather, the design lead, the market research lead, and, you know, we'd form a little team for delivering the client work. And then I would also support the sort of bigger projects that my boss would be running. So that's kind of how I transitioned from the verbal team to going into this sort of consultative type of role. And I did that for about 5.5 years. So I think I stayed on the verbal team for about 9 months and then made that move. And then for the next 5.5 years, I did more of that. But it wasn't just naming. You know, naming was a huge chunk of it. And when it comes to healthcare naming, especially pharmaceutical naming, the creative bit is one portion of time, and then the market research is a much longer period of time.
Right. I was just going to ask you about the market research, because I think that is another place where having a linguistics background is actually incredibly useful, although you might not think it is at first. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So when you're planning for market research, it just takes weeks. You know, you have to prepare it and work with the client, and then we had a vendor that we would work with, but you put the questionnaire together, you're recording what the names sound like, you do handwriting samples, but you're putting these names in front of the relevant healthcare professionals that are to do with this project. So for example, if you've got a project to do with COPD, then you want to make sure that the people that you're putting these name candidates in front of are those who deal with COPD. So you want to make sure that they get, that you just get some feedback as to, do they sound like other names that are currently in the market? Do they sound like other kinds of drugs that we don't want them to sound like? Mm-hmm. Is it any other negative connotation at all? And then we have to sort of analyze that and then put together a report to present to the client and make an assessment really as to whether these are strong candidates or risky candidates. The linguistics part, I think, is, probably when you do sort of get a bit of feedback as to what if it sounds like something or if it looks mm-hmm. like something, it's still at that point quite minimal, I'd say, because it's kind of too late really to make any changes. By the time you get to the market research phase, which is quite time consuming and, mm-hmm. and pricey, you want to have filtered out any risks. So usually that would have been done much, much earlier, and any kind of linguistic thinking would happen then. But that's not to say that, you know, throughout the sort of market research or post, that there isn't an opportunity to have another kind of lens of, let's look at it this mm-hmm. way, which ones are our favorite, which one do we select? It's quite a process when it comes to a pharmaceutical name in particular.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's such a long process anyway, right? I mean, a pharmaceutical development cycle can be like 8 to 10 years, right? Mm-hmm. From when they start to when it actually hits the market. My company has been involved in a couple of them, and we stopped doing it because it was so long between the first steps and when the thing happened. You know, a drug might hit the market, and we were like, did we do that? I can't even remember. Like, let's look back at our records and see if we named that thing.
Right. Yeah, you do have to be patient yep. when it comes to sort of seeing the fruits of your labor. But it's an interesting specialty to have. It's definitely something that you can sort of feel like, oh, we had a little part in that. We know that it's something that it's memorable. You know, you can see some of these pharmaceutical adverts on TV. And but to your point, actually, sometimes you'll see it and, you know, another team member will say something like, oh, you know, our company did that. But you know, it's like the people from years and years and years before, because it took that long to then appear on TV as an advert. But some of them are a little quicker and you can sort of point to it and say, ah, oh, that one. Because I actually, the first project, the first piece of business that I did land, I actually went through the naming process and the design process, the logo for it. And that I did see is it is out there. So I can sort of point to it and say, ah, oh, yes, that I actually won mm-hmm. that piece of business. It's in the world. I can see it. And that's, you know, that can be something really cool as well. And that actually tends to be medical devices, by the way.
Yeah.
So drugs, you can wait a long, long time. Medical devices are a little quicker.
Yeah. And there are some drugs that are a lot quicker because they're sort of in a different class. We've named a couple of things that were prescription drugs. One of them is an eye drop, and it's not in like for medical treatment, you know, it's not like a life-saving cornea treatment sort of thing. It's to temporarily cure your farsightedness, and the lead time on that was like a couple of years. So it went much, much quicker because it was just a sort of a different class of drug. And it was cool when it finally came out because we hadn't been working on it all that long. And it was like, oh, look, there it is on the shelf. We saw an ad for it and everything. I wanted to just back up a little bit to be clear with people. So for folks who are listening, in case this is a career path you are thinking of pursuing, there can be, in my experience, and you can chime in on this, there's a big difference between the kinds of roles you might have depending on the size of the company that you're with, right? So if you're working for a large multinational like Landor or Interbrand or Lippincott or Siegel Gale or whoever, the roles do tend to be really siloed. So you might be working in business development, or you might be working in strategy, and you might be working in creative, and rarely do you get to cross over with those other things. You tend to be working on a team, and then you hand things off to other people. And if you want to change your job, you just go and you work in a different office. Like, you might physically be working in a different building from where you used to work. In smaller companies, you might share responsibilities with other people. And it sounds like at Addison Whitney, there was some crossover there. When you're at a small company like mine, you do everything. So partly you have to think about what you want to do. Like, what kind of person are you? Do you like having multiple responsibilities, you know, then maybe a smaller company is better for you because you get to do lots of different things. There's a lot more pressure and you have to have a lot of balls in the air at one time. But if you're good at that and you really enjoy it, maybe that's where you want to be. But if you really like to focus and just do one thing and get really good at one thing, maybe a bigger company is better because you get to just do the one thing that you do. And if you want to switch, then you can switch. So your work style is really important. Like, you need to know what you like to do, because if it's a mismatch between your work style and the place that you go to work, you are not going to be very happy.
That's true. And it's, I guess it's also just thinking, if the goal is to just get into naming specifically, is kind of thinking, okay, well, how could I do that? You know, is it only through the verbal branding team? Because I did meet some people who they really wanted to do brand strategy, and they were sort of, you know, hitting their head against the brick wall, just trying to figure out, okay, how do I get in? And they went through sales, you know. So it's kind of thinking, you know, what would you be open to do as well,
right,
in order to get the sort of the job? And actually, it's not thinking about, oh, I've got to do this and I've got to do my time and then I can do that. Actually, it's a really great learning experience.
Yes, absolutely.
As to, you know, how to connect with potential clients, how to speak about the work that you're doing. And then you can move into actually doing the work. So I think, yeah, as you mentioned, with the smaller companies, it is actually kind of easier. I mean, it's still quite sort of divided and in terms siloed in terms of, you know, a lot of people like just doing that part of the work, and that's totally fine. We need people who naming and just doing market research and all that. But there are some individuals that I think it's actually super beneficial to cross over, because the best people to sell actually are the ones who have done the work. So the ones who and were doing brand strategy or were doing naming or design or whatever else, and then they can actually sell sometimes even better because they can speak to the work that is being done. So sometimes it's a couple of things. It's, you know, small company versus big company. Sometimes it's easier to sort of step into those smaller companies first if the goal is one of these bigger companies. But there's pros and cons. You know, the bigger companies like the Interbrands and the Future Brands and et cetera, it can be that they can be very much, you know, in one place only, you know, the big cities, whereas some of these other companies like Addison & Whitney, it's mostly remote now. So it's there's some trade-offs to think about too, but definitely some opportunities if people are willing to sort of think a little outside the box.
Yeah. And a lot of the bigger companies too, like you were saying before, will offer internships. So it's a good way to test it out, see if you like it, see if the work is for you. It is a funny thing to say, but I am always very upfront about this. As someone who's been doing naming for like close to 30 years, I'm not very good at naming. Like, I am not a creative person. I really and truly, I can do it, but one of my partners at Catchword, Maria, she's like the most creative person in the world. She's amazing. I cannot understand where her creativity comes from. She's come up with most of the amazing names that Catchword's portfolio has had. And I just can't do that. I am really good at the strategy stuff, you know, when we have to come up with naming architectures and things like that. I love that kind of stuff, making trees and sorting things into piles and figuring out, you know, what should the strategy be for all these different names that a company might have. And I didn't know I was good at that until I sat down and started doing it and went to meet with a client, and they were like, oh, we have all these names and we don't know what to do with them. And we don't know what our strategy should be and how we should move forward. You know, should we just use the company name or should we have all these product names? And it seemed so obvious to me, like, yeah, this is what makes sense, guys. Like, just do this. And they were like, oh, I see. Okay. Why didn't we think of that? But it was a thing that had never occurred to me before. And I didn't know I was good at it until I started doing it. So I think that is true for a lot of the aspects of naming and marketing and brand strategy and things like that. Like, you won't know if you're good at it until you start trying to do it. And then you'll find out if you like it and if you're good at it.
Well, definitely. And it's funny you say that, because obviously I went to the verbal branding team thinking, right, I'm going to stay here. You know, I just mm-hmm. want to do naming. And then I realized, oh, no, wait a minute. I actually want to work mm-hmm. with clients on naming and all these other things. So it's not sometimes until you actually do it that you realize mm-hmm. what kind of namer or what kind of branding person you are.
Yep.
And you can sort of picture those people. Well, I can picture these people, the ones who are the strategists, the ones who are super creative, and the ones who... I think I kind of think of myself maybe as I like orchestrating mm-hmm. the movement to get something done.
Yeah.
I guess
yeah.
it's kind of like I know from the beginning and the end what needs to get done. And I know this, you know, this is what we need, and providing enough naming input and strategy and things like that to then get it done. And then having some, you know, some good insights and things like that. So it's not until, like you said, until you actually do it that you sort of figure out, actually, what am I better at? What mm-hmm. role should you have? And it's not necessarily the one you go into thinking that you would do.
Yeah. And all of this is by way of saying you don't have to be a super creative person to do naming. Because
yeah.
I am living proof of that. And I also wanted to circle back to the stuff about market research. So you were speaking specifically about the kind of research that you do on, say, pharmaceutical naming or medical naming. There's a lot of research that goes into consumer products, for example, or just, you know, company names or product names in general. And I find that having a linguistic background for that is extremely useful, because a lot of it, well, I'll say a lot of research, even when it's done by professional research firms, is bad, because the people who do it don't understand how language works. So in order to get good research, you need to have good input, and then you need to evaluate the output very carefully. And it's all language. So if you don't ask the questions in the correct way, you're not going to get good answers. And I have seen so much bad research because it's done by researchers who don't understand how to ask the right questions. And it's kind of weird to me that these are researchers and they don't understand that they're asking questions in the wrong way. And all of that stuff is just like doing experiments, right? If you're doing your linguistic experiments as you're getting your master's or your PhD or whatever, like, you know how to do that already. You know how to gather data. You know how to go to respondents and ask them questions to get the best data that you can get. And doing market research is exactly the same sort of thing. So to, you know, put it in very simple terms, if you are looking for responses on names, right, you've got five names and you want to figure out which might be the most appropriate, you don't go to people and show them five names and go, tell me which is the best. Like, that's going to get you terrible answers. You might present them and say, which is most appropriate, or which makes you think of whatever the main message is that you're trying to do. And then you listen very carefully and you note their responses. But I have seen so much research where, you know, they'd sit people down in a room and they'd say to them, like, here's a new name, like it or spike it. And you're like, oh, don't ask them like that. It's terrible. So I think as a linguist, you can add so much value to that kind of research that is just not there in a lot of cases.
Yeah, maybe that's the difference between, you know, a lot of healthcare type mm-hmm. of research and consumer goods, because to be honest, I haven't been privy to that side of things. I think actually the healthcare market research is quite heavily quantitative.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Yes.
Yeah. Right. And then I rarely got the chance to do that kind of project where you could sort of speak to a room full of people and say, you know, what do you think about that? Does that tell you this? Does that tell you that? But we're always careful to say, though, with market research, it's super valuable, but it is one component of a decision you have to make.
Yeah, it's a data point.
Right. You have to consider other things, because you're putting something into the world that mm-hmm. in theory doesn't really sort of exist yet. So you want to be careful of priming certain answers.
Exactly. Yes.
But yeah, I think there's something to... I mean, obviously, when you think about the world of naming and market research, clearly things have evolved the way they are, and they're successful to an extent, but that doesn't mean that there's no room for improvement. And one of the things, as you mentioned, is that you sort of ask, okay, well, you sort of look at the name in isolation. That was the one sort of big thing that I noticed kind of linguistically that was not wrong, but missing in the evaluation of a name. So we build them in isolation, then we present them in isolation, and then it's, okay, here's the name. And we didn't really put it into a sentence and sort of test it sort of verbally, either, you know, audio or written down to see, well, does this work with other words that are next to them? How does that name impact the rest of the sentence and vice versa? How does the grammar affect the name? Mm-hmm. So one thing I kind of noticed, actually, whether that would be in the creative process early on or in market research, is actually to put the name into a sentence and show it to people.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, context is super important, you know, because you rarely encounter a name without context, right? Mm-hmm. There's always something, unless you're reading the Wall Street Journal. And even then, you're liable to see it with words surrounding it or something, right? You know, right. It's rarely contextless. You don't see a word floating in midair with nothing around it.
Yeah. But yeah, with market research, it is a fascinating, I've always loved research. It's a funny one, though, because you can, there was one project where I worked on, and you want to sort of come up with the most creative name, you know, as an agency. You're just like, okay, this is really cool. The client is going to think this, and you do market research, and then suddenly, you know, you realize the target audience thinks a completely different way. So sometimes that's why it exists. You know, you have to sort of, the importance of doing market research is kind of realizing that we have our own biases, and you want to check with the ultimate target audience. What do they think? Do they want something super creative, or do they want something descriptive that tells them exactly what this thing does? And sometimes that's the case. So that's another reason that research is super useful.
Yeah. I think as a linguist, it helps you to be very sensitive to a client's preconceived notions. I know a lot of clients come in with preconceived notions that they've gotten through business school. I'm not trying to slam business school. You went to business school. But, you know, I have been in meetings where they're like, you know, well, whatever this new name is for a company, it can't be misspelled, because misspelled names never go. And I'll sit there and say, oh, you mean like Google? And they say, oh, you mean like Tinder? Well, and you know, you have to have examples at hand that you can pull up. Say, well, it can't be more than six letters. Oh, you mean like Microsoft? Well, and you know, like they have these ideas in their heads because they've been told this and they believe it, but they've never actually examined their assumptions to see whether that actually matches up to examples in the real world. And so it's very useful to be able to pull examples from the real world that will contradict what they're saying and make them open to more possibilities, because they're just going off of these assumptions that were told to them at one point and they've never really looked beyond that. And you know that that's going to make them very difficult to work with, because what they're asking for simply is impossible. You know, we want a name that doesn't have any creative spelling and it's only six letters and it goes consonant, vowel. And it's like, well, you're asking for the impossible, so we will not be able to create a name for you.
Well, I think it's just, you know, knowing, a human nature a little bit. We like rules, but then even obviously our grammar is just replete with exceptions to the rule. So I know it's weird, because you think, well, if you follow the rules you get a boring name, but if you don't follow the rules you might get something that stands out. So I think it's preparing the field with these examples that you mentioned to just almost break the sort of that, just knowing that the client or the human is gonna think, okay the perfect name is supposed to be this. Yes. And so by showing them and just starting out the conversation with a bunch of different names that are all sorts of possibilities, to show them the spectrum, basically just a big map of just all the different kinds of things that you can have, suddenly their world just opens up, their minds just open up, and just like, okay, a successful name is actually not just one thing, it is many, many different things. But you know, what are you looking for? Like, what do you want?
Yeah. Yeah. It's the possibilities. And once they embrace the possibility of possibilities, then you know that you can have a good working relationship, because otherwise They're looking for the impossible, and you will never be able to satisfy them. And as a namer, that is the most frustrating thing of all, is a client that just has an idea of what they want. They can't articulate it, but they shoot down every single thing that you show them. And I'm sure you've been in that situation, and there's nothing you can do. You know, you try so hard and you try your best to be their therapist and work out, what is it that you want, really? Like, what am I showing you that's not hitting the mark? Tell me, please tell me. I want to make you happy so bad. And it's not doing it. I don't know what they want.
Yeah, it can be super frustrating. But, you know, part of the work is kind of a mentality of, you know, challenge accepted, right? You're just like, okay, the positive side of this is let's find out. Let's see how much we can push this. But yes, I mean, it's super frustrating when it's just a bit of a blinkered view of what is possible when you've tried, you know, your hardest to really open up the possibilities that you mentioned. But yeah, it's, you know, as a linguist, there's lots of, I say linguist, you know, because there's those out there that have, you know, PhDs and have taught linguistics. I kind of, you know, I did a master's and I have an interest in it, so I'm always careful of saying, you know, linguistics or linguist specialist. But as someone who has an interest in linguistics and applying it, you know, once I spent sort of my time at Addison Whitney while I was there, I actually did apply for a PhD in linguistics, you know, to research brand names, because at the time when I was doing my master's, I was thinking, should I do a PhD or not? But I asked advice from my professor at the time, and he said, don't do it unless you have a burning topic that you can stand to look into for years and in great detail, then don't do a PhD. So when I was at Addison Whitney studying brand names, I thought to myself, brand names, like, what a great topic. So I did that part-time, because at the time Oxford didn't offer a part-time study as an option, but then it suddenly did, and I thought, this is fate. I'll apply and I'll study. So I was looking to brand names, and I had a great supervisor who helped me try and figure out what's interesting about researching brand names from a linguistic perspective. And that was the grammar. So you could look at the study of brand names from things that have already been done. So I think we talked about, you know, how the words kind of break apart. So, for example, morphology has a lot of examples with brand names. You know, how do we put these names together, these concepts together, what sort of letter strings, etc. Phonetic symbolism has kind of been studied a fair bit. But what hadn't been studied as much was just the grammar. So how thinking about things like singular versus plural, using a determiner like the or a, you know, how do these things help us to interpret a brand name as a brand name as opposed to anything else? So that's kind of what my the PhD was going to be about. So just as a side note, I did that for about 2.5 years. And during that 2.5 years, I have a family. And obviously, it's, you know, the value and the time that I can actually put towards this PhD, the time kind of decreases. And my perception of the value of it also decreases, because, you know, you've got work happening as well, and that's going just fine. So just a combination of things, not to say that it wasn't sort of a good amount of time. It just wasn't it wasn't good timing to continue. Yeah. So I paused it. But, you know, I have sort of this 2.5 years of time where I was reading a bunch of articles and textbooks to do with brand names and the grammar. And I did put together some information, and you saw that in the presentation. So I'm actually glad that, you know, I did have a couple of outputs, you know, to put to that time. But it's still a field ripe for research, and my goal, and it's still the case, it might not be now, but at some point when I finish and I sort of write something up, is to combine the world of linguistics and the business of naming, because I think there's so much that you can learn from linguistics and applying it to brand naming that could just make it just a more interesting field, and also not just for the sake of making it interesting, but actually to provide a better product to the client. It makes economic sense to add linguistics into the mix.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So yeah, just to let people know out there that if they wanted to study anything or research anything, I think brand names is a really great subject, because I think it's got a lot of applications in the business world.
Totally agree. There are some interesting papers on brand names that the Name Society has published. The Name Society, by the way, is now open access. So you can go to the website for the journal and it's all free. So you can go and read whatever's there. And there's a couple of pretty good papers. I cannot call them to mind immediately, but there are some good things. There are other papers that are in, there's a Journal of Brand Strategy that has some good things and various others of varying quality. Some are not written by linguists, and I'm not sure about the theories that lie behind them. So it would be great to see more linguists doing research on them. And the topic that you brought up there is a really interesting one, and it's something that I and the other folks in the Linguistics Career Launch get asked all the time, which is, should I finish my PhD? And it's all of those things that you mentioned. It's the trade-off, you know, is it worth it to spend the time and the money and the energy to finish or to embark on one if you have a master's? Because what is the return going to be? And if you have something that you're really passionate about and you have a clear path towards it and maybe you have the support and you have the time, yeah, you could definitely go for it. But if you don't, it might not be the path for you right now. It wasn't for me. I'm ABD. All I had to do was write my dissertation to get my PhD, and I didn't because I was in graduate school for too long and I had no money and I had no support. And I just, you know, it was a choice between, you know, not to be too hyperbolic, but starving and getting my PhD and you know, getting a job at a naming company, which is what I ended up doing. But it was really tough. And for some people, they just really don't have a choice.
Yeah, I think it's a good one to do a PhD or to finish a PhD or not to finish a PhD. Yeah. I think if you can, especially early on, then why not? I think when you're sort of doing it at different stages in life and you're sort of thinking, you know, and then people will value it, you know, and then you'll go to a company and they'll see it as super, super valuable and they'll pay you this and they'll pay you that. It's a difficult one because you think, well, surely this is, you know, a really solid piece of original research that I put out into the world and it should translate into something. And unfortunately, sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. And so it can be a really hard decision to say, well, I've spent this much time in it already. But really, it's just as things change, as the years go by, different things happen. Like you said, sometimes, you know, work has to come first. Maybe it's going well, maybe it's not. Family, like things like that. It doesn't, and especially now, I don't think it means that's it.
Yeah,
and I don't think it means anything like failure either. It just means the time's not right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
And maybe other things are going well. I think if I would almost see it as sort of a sunk cost, you know, you put time into it and it was good for the time that you did it, but then it might not be, I wouldn't just continue with something just for the sake of it if it didn't make any sense. You know, if you looked at all aspects of your personal and professional life and it doesn't make sense, then, and which is what I did, just stop. Because there's other things, you know, going on that you value more at the time. But it doesn't mean, especially like this day and age, that you can't come back to it. And
sure,
in my mind and in the future, I think I'm probably going to come back to it.
Absolutely.
But it's just a call you have to make. But I think knowing that, and maybe this is why this is important, this podcast is important, is that the world of academia isn't the only place to apply linguistics. And I think that's coming across more and more and more. So that decision might not be that hard in the end to either continue or to maybe do something else because there are other opportunities.
Yeah. I'm so glad you said that it doesn't mean you failed, because that certainly was the feeling from academia for a very long time. If you were in a PhD program and you didn't finish your PhD for whatever reason, that was definitely the message, was that you failed. And that was horribly unfair to people to make you feel that way, because a lot of times it was out of your control. I mean, you just, you know, you didn't finish for whatever reason. And it wasn't that it was a moral failure on your part. It's like you couldn't finish. So, you know, there were other things going on in your life. And yeah, you can come back and finish at whatever age that you want to, whatever stage of your life that you want to. And I have been very strongly encouraging people to not use the word just when they say, well, I just have a master's or I'm just working. It's like, okay, stop that word just, because whatever you're doing, it's important. You're doing what you should be doing. You're right where you need to be right now. There's no just about it. So let us stop saying that. And there's nothing about it that's just. So let's go back to you, because I want to hear about what you're doing at MarketCraft.
So, yeah, I guess slightly went away from naming a little bit. So I was at Addison Whitney, and then I moved to another company to do a little bit more marketing. So instead of it being purely sort of naming and branding, I had started to sort of look into doing just more sort of, you know, now that you've built this brand, applying it into the real world, or putting it out there into the real world. So sort of stretching from branding to marketing to communications. So I was doing that for again, healthcare companies, mostly med techs. And the company that I've since joined now is wholly devoted to med tech. So there is that aspect of naming still. It's kind of a small proportion of what I would do day to day, I'd say. Is maybe it's things like helping with a naming system here and there, or helping with developing a category name, maybe naming products. It's pretty minimal, because I think I've just, I have really found an interest in working with medtech. So clients who just have this really cool technology and product and want to let the world know about it, but just don't know how. And that can be from, you know, building their brand. It's mostly about how to communicate it into the outside world. So what kind of digital presence do they have, if any? What kind of support do they need? So it's MarketCraft is kind of all about helping these medtech, mostly medtech startups, just being their support in terms of marketing and branding and sort of all of the above. Maybe even connecting them to investors, maybe providing a little bit of that sales enablement support. But the core of it really is sort of just being on social platforms like LinkedIn and X. You know, how do you get in front of your target audience? So it's stepping aside from naming a little bit and more into just language, actually. It's still really connected into, you know, how do you use language? How do you use persuasive language and really distill down sometimes very technological engineering type of language into something that your target audience is going to connect with?
Yeah, kind of a holistic marketing approach.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of looking back on my career so far, I think part of it, which is kind of a nice learning, if people are willing to do so, is be open to stepping into different types of roles and companies that might not necessarily have been the thing that you thought you were going to do 10 or 20 years ago. I think it's okay to sort of, you know, go through your professional life and just see what's available, and then jump for some of these opportunities, because you never know what you actually are interested in. Because, you know, when you are at school or at university, you've only got a certain pool, you know, you can only see a certain amount of things. And it's only by sometimes taking a bit of a sideways, like, look at things where you're just like, oh yeah, you know what, over there, that's actually pretty interesting. Let me do that. So yeah, another sort of aspect to, if you're at university or you are sort of pursuing a degree at whatever level, is sometimes it's just looking at the thing that's a little bit different that you didn't think of that could lead into something that actually you really like.
Yep, that is absolutely great advice. And I was thinking as you were talking, there are still people who use the term job hopping in a very derogatory way, which I think is garbage, right? Because when you move from job to job, it's what you were just talking about. You're learning, you're doing different things. Like, you're pushing your boundaries, you're taking on different challenges, you're doing it because you're setting new goals for yourself. And you shouldn't think of it as, you know, you're some kind of dilettante or something, you know, like, you're doing it because you want to do different and new things. And that's very positive. It's all about building yourself and learning how to do new things.
Yeah, the trend of job hopping is an interesting one, because, you know, back in the day you stayed in something, you know, potentially your whole life, and there's benefits to that, but there's also disadvantages, you know, some pretty big cons to that too. So it's, you'll get people at companies who are those kinds of people, and that's totally fine. They bring actually some great depth of experience and knowledge about things, but then you're also missing what's happening in other industries and in other companies. And that's where actually the people who have been at different companies can really bring some good insights. So I've always been the kind of, okay, well, you could stay at this one company your whole life, or, you know, you could try something else out and just learn different ways of doing things. And sometimes I'll hear some people who say, there was a friend of mine who said, you know, I didn't think that things could be better than they currently are until they moved jobs.
Yeah. And then they actually could. Yeah. So I wish there was a better word for it. I think that term, unfortunately, is tainted, and I have been searching for another one and I can't find it. But let's remove the stigma from that. That it's not bad. It's just different, and it should be fine. Everybody should do the thing that they want to do if it makes them a better worker, right? Like if sticking at a job makes you a better worker, then you should do that. If moving on makes you a better worker, then you should do that too. Like, yes. Do what works for you.
Absolutely.
This has been great. I have one more question for you before we wrap up. Have you been to Egypt?
Yes, I have. I went before going to university. I actually went with my grandmother on a short trip. Uh-huh. We went to Luxor. It was a really, really sort of, I think, the biggest culture shock. I was 17 at the time. I think I was super keen to just go before I embarked on a degree to do with Egyptology. But yes, I've been to Egypt, and that is something at some point I'm trying to figure out how to weave that back into my life somehow. Uh-huh. But it's still a bit of a challenge, but still have an interest and a passion for ancient history, especially Egypt.
Very cool. I have been to Cairo and Alexandria, and it was amazing. It was really good. I don't think I'd go there now. It seems like it could be a little bit dicey, but it was amazing. I'm one of those people, I'm constantly yelled at wherever I go, because I'm always touching things that I'm not supposed to. So when we went to see the pyramids, and especially the Great Pyramid, I was like touching everything, and I was constantly getting yelled at. And my friend was like, would you stop touching things? Like, no, this is the only chance of my life I'm going to get to touch these things, and I'm touching them. So
I know there's a weird compulsion to do that, isn't there? Just to sort of, I don't know, just feel like something tangible, like the history of it. You're just like, oh, it's really there. It's not just in a book. It's there.
I could not stop myself. We were outside, and then, you know, like, you're there, and there are these, like, the blocks are just so huge. And as we were going, I just had to put my hands on them. It's like, I am touching history right now. And the guy's like, come on, move along. It's like, no, I want to touch them. So that's awesome. Can I put your LinkedIn link in the show notes in case people want to contact you for advice or informational interviews or anything?
Yes, of course. Yeah, that's totally fine.
All right. That is great. Well, Deborah, thank you so much for taking this hour to talk with me. This was fascinating and wonderful, and I'm so glad to talk shop about naming with someone. This was just tremendous.
Yeah, thank you. It was really enjoyable as well.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held two online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.